Hey everybody, this is Wade with Wade for Wireless, and today I have something special for you. We're always wondering about these guys that train the climbers, and here I have one. I have Todd Horning of Safety One, and he's going to talk about not only his training, which he not only, you know, he did tower climbing and so on, but he is Sprat 3 certified, and he talks about what you have to go through to get Sprat certified. And it's definitely not a not something where you go sit 8 hours and you get a certification. You're there for a week, you have a written test, you have a verbal test, and then you have to prove your skills. It sounds pretty cool. So he talks about that. And each time it gets a little harder and it's a little nerve-wracking, and it is pass-fail. You don't just put everyone through. So I thought that was interesting. He talks about some of the classes he had, you know, people, well, he talks about one guy in particular I can remember that he rescued during class. It does happen. Now, the good thing about in class, you know, they have everything rigged ahead of time. So if they have to save somebody, they can do it in a matter of minutes rather than worrying about if they have everything, if everything's in the truck, and they're well prepared to help anybody. And that's something on the tower I think we take for granted. I think we're up there, you know, we do the best that we can, and I think a lot of times we're not well prepared. In fact, I would speculate that's one of the reasons the fire department gets called so often, is because they maybe, you know, the climbers don't have the rope to do the rescue, they don't have the equipment, or maybe they're just not experienced enough, meaning they're not well prepared. So anyways, Todd's a pretty interesting guy. I think you'll enjoy the interview, and I think he brings up a lot of points about training and what he went through, and it makes you respect this guy a little bit. And rope training for him has become a passion. He's so into it, and it's nice to see someone who's really passionate about it. So enjoy. Here's Todd.
You're Sprat 3. Now, I got to tell you, and you probably hear this, I would imagine you hear it from your class quite a bit, people coming through. A lot of tower climbers ask me about Sprat, and I send them the website, and I send them information. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So what I want you to do is articulate to these guys what you have to do for Sprat. Start with one, and then go 1, 2, and 3, because okay. It's really, like I talk to a lot of guys that are Sprat certified. It's really, to me, it's really impressive what you have to do to get certified just for 1 and 2.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, if you could just go into it, just start with one, what you have to do, and then just go up, like, to each, the next level, you know, 2
okay.
and then 3.
Yeah, excellent. So, I guess I won't go in too much to what Sprat is, because I feel like a lot of people will have a good idea of that already, if they're looking at that. But rope access has been around a while. It kind of originally came from the enthusiasts in the caving world, and the guys rock climbing and that kind of stuff. And from there, it was developed over into a little more beefier equipment and some little more redundant techniques, which is how we came up with the industrial set of practices, which is what Sprat is. There's another organization called IRATA, which is the International Rope Access Organization, and they were around first, but we've kind of refined that a little bit and tightened up some of the techniques and done things a little bit different for what is now Sprat, which is basically the most well-known in the U.S. as the certification agency who, you know, certifies candidates and writes safe practices for how we do our work at height. So basically how the process works, there's 3 levels, level 1, 2, and 3. When people start out, they will come in and start out at level 1 if they're new. They do have something called direct entry to level 2 and level 3, which is basically where if a technician has experience, say they were an IRATA technician in another country and they're coming to the U.S. and the contracts they're going to be working on want to require a Sprat certification. So if they've already got the skill set and the experience, they can actually direct entry into level 2 or level 3, where they will come and test out. Basically, you kind of skip levels because you can prove that you're already there. But initially, cool. It does start at level 1. So what the candidate will do, and anybody off the street who has an interest in climbing, could come in and start as a level one, and there's the training that's required. It's a four-day training, which typically averages about 40 hours, sometimes a little more, and consists of classroom training and mostly hands-on and on-rope skill training. And they will run through all the skills during the week, and then on that Friday or that fifth day, they're tested by an outside independent evaluator who doesn't know them from anyone else.
So the guy that evaluates you, he's not in class with you, he's not a teacher, he hasn't been with you all week?
Not at all. And that's almost a good thing for the candidate, because if a guy's got a habit, you know, of leaving carabiners unlocked or you know, whatever it may be, he's got a mistake that he's made three or four times throughout the week, there's no prejudice from that evaluator looking for him to make that same mistake. And, you know, the other side to that is, as a candidate, you're maybe a little more nervous because you've got this outsider who's just showed up and now they're testing you.
Yeah.
So that can be a little bit tough. I remember when I first did my level one a number of years ago, and it was a pretty nerve-wracking experience. And I wasn't just starting out. I had been climbing for a long time, and even still, as being an experienced climber, it was a lot to take in 1 week. It was pretty rough. But I got through it, and I passed my first one. So anyway, the actual evaluation day, how that works is you start out and you do a written exam, which takes you usually around 30 minutes or so. Most people will pass that if they've studied throughout the week. There's nothing terribly difficult with that. From there, you go into what's called the oral evaluation, where all the candidates will stand in a circle, and the evaluator gives each of them a different piece of equipment, and they are to talk about all the critical items related to that piece of equipment. So, you know, the do's and don'ts of it, how you use it, how you inspect it, and he wants to hear a number of critical safety items associated with that.
So do you remember what you got? Like, what did he hand you?
When I first did my level one, I was given the descent device, which at the time we were using the Petzl ID. And that was kind of a tough one, but at the same time, I felt a little confident because I actually, you know, I was training guys to use IDs in tower trainings. So I was fairly familiar with the device, so I guess I was pretty confident going into it, and I guess I did pretty well. I didn't, there wasn't anything I didn't say that was critical. So now throughout the day, they have a scoring system that they will use, and there's minor discrepancies and there's major discrepancies, and you're allowed two minor discrepancies, and on the third minor, it's a failure or a major for the day. There's also other safety items that we call the majors. So if they make a mistake, such as going onto a single rope system, that's a major, and that will constitute as an instant failure for the day.
Wow.
Yep. And
so one major mistake and you're out. That's
yes,
something to think about.
Absolutely. It certainly escalates the stress level a little bit, but at the same time, you know, it's people look at that certification as really kind of the one recognizable certification in the industry, to where it really carries some weight. You know, a lot of these training companies will issue a certification of completion. You know, it's almost an attendance record. Where you can sit through a course and just say, yeah, I'm a climber now, and we feel that it should be a little higher than that.
Yeah, let me ask you something, though. Were there a lot of guys that were just nervous, that just blew it because of nerves? I mean, was that a normal thing?
Absolutely. And actually, it's interesting because at least the evaluator that we use locally has really, I mean, I've seen him, I think it was, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago when we first started dealing with him. He was much more stringent. And then actually in recent years, he's come in and he gives a very big speech at the beginning that says, you know, we want to evaluate your skills. And if you are making a mistake because you're nervous, that doesn't really show us your skills. So he's actually changed some of his processes to try and make that a little less stressful. And I think it's working pretty well for him.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good that he does that, because I can imagine your first time there, you know, it's, like you said, it's probably a lot of stress, because especially if you get like one minor, and then you're like, oh, you probably think about, oh no, I got one. I hope I don't get another.
Or especially if you've got two minors, because then you know that the next one is the end of your day.
Oh my God, yeah. And you know, if you do screw up, you have to do the whole thing again, right? The whole week long class and the.
Yeah, basically you've got to retest, and they've changed the rules a few times. Sometimes they make you wait 30 days, and sometimes you can just retest like a day or two later. It kind of depends on the evaluator and where you're at. But we have a couple guys here at our company who are on some of the committees with Sprat, and one of the things they're doing that's very neat is they've got two documents now. They've got certification requirements and safe practices, and that's a good system that explains, you know, what you have to do to successfully complete each level of training, and then the certification test that goes along with it, and then also they go into talking about the techniques that they want to see. Well, now what they've kind of seen is, rope access is used in bridge inspection and wind energy, and we've got guys doing it on high voltage electrical structures and telecom towers. And in all honesty, every one of those industries requires different gear, different techniques, you know, different backup devices, different ascenders, descenders, different, you know, material of your harness. If you're working around high voltage, you're going to have, you know, arc rated and FR stuff. If you're, you're working in an environment where you're grinding or welding, you're going to have ropes that are more resistant to heat. And so what they've done is they're splitting it all into these subcommittees, and it's industry specific standards. And like, for example, we're on the telecom standard, the wind standard, and then we're working on actually writing the high voltage tower standard.
Oh, wow.
And what that's going to do is break it out for each industry. So I think in terms of safety, we've still got a lot to go, but we're making good progress.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'll tell you what I like about Sprat and IRATA. I put the links in the past that you guys, on the website at least, the Sprat and IRATA website,
mm-hmm.
It's very open. You share everything. I mean, you don't really – I know there are some things you charge for, the membership and a lot of documentation – but you guys give out a lot of documentation that people can learn from. And that I try to put that in my blog all the time. Not all the time, but, you know, I try to write a blog from time to time and have the links in because, you know, it's information, if nothing else. Maybe it'll make someone interested or maybe they'll learn something from it. So,
absolutely. Well, you know, we're all in business to make money and keep the lights on. That's why we come to work every day. But, you know, the other thing is, We really do care about the safety of everybody and each other. You know, even at competing agencies, we never want to hear about accidents. You know, that's not something you ever want to see. And if we figure out a technique that really lets somebody work safer, you know, why not get that out there and share it with people?
Yeah, I agree with that. So you went through level one. Is level two and three pretty much the same thing, or is it more complicated?
You know, it's actually the same process for each level. But I got to say, each level brings kind of a different element of anxiety, if you will, because, you know, level one for me was the hardest because you're kind of learning how to do it. And then when you go into two and you go into three, it's really just more and more skills, but the environment is the same. You're on ropes, you're at height, you're just performing more difficult rescues. One of the things, too, that I didn't really mention is they require a number of hours and experience to go from one level to the next. So it's not like you could just take 3 weeks of training back to back to back and go to level three. You have to spend a minimum of 500 hours at each level to be able to go to the next level.
Okay. When you say 500 hours, is that working hours? Do you have to log your working hours, or is that just...
So there's actually a definition of loggable hours within the document from Sprat, which talks about, you know, inspecting your equipment, rigging your ropes, training, and then actually on-rope working hours are all loggable hours. But the evaluators have actually gotten pretty picky now about going in and looking. You have a logbook that you have to have signed off for all of your jobs and your hours by level threes that are managing the site. And they've actually gone in and said, you know, hey, tell me about this job. Tell me about that job. And they want to see you know, the level three cert has gotten to the point where they really want to see that you've had some experience doing many different things and you're well-rounded, so that, I mean, literally, if you're going to be in charge of a site and have other guys on rope, you got to really know what you're doing.
Yeah, I believe it. For crying out loud, I mean, it's a lot of responsibility, and that's something, you know, I talk about, and you guys know, I talked to Kevin about it too, Kevin Carter there, and it's really amazing now. Tower crews used to always have like two or three experienced guys and one new guy, but now it just seems like, I'm talking tower crews specifically, but I see how it relates here. Now you have a lot of younger guys coming up, and there's so much work on it, and I think a lot of the older guys are either retiring or getting out of it. And, you know, I climbed for 12 years, and I got out of it for a lot of reasons. But you have all these young guys. You really don't have the experience there. So I think with the Spratt certification, I think they are just trying to weed out people that are just, you know, filling in the blanks, so to speak.
Well, it's an industry where it's certainly not for everybody. And they don't want to have a reputation for just handing out cards. And, you know, their thing is, if you're going to have that certification, they want to know that anywhere you go, they can say, oh, I'm a Sprat 2 or a 3 or a 1 or whatever, and they know kind of in the back of their mind what that means. You know, whereas if you say, I've got, you know, XYZ training company's tower climbing card, well, who are they? What do they do? You know, do they really know what they're doing? That kind of stuff. So, you know, it's a very meaningful certification, which is cool.
Oh, yeah. And that's something I want to get out to the tower industry, how important it is, you know, how serious it is, because I think a lot of guys just don't know. I don't think they understand. And you know, maybe it's because, you're right, maybe because they go through some climbing classes, you know, from whoever. Obviously not from Safety One, but maybe they go through other climbing classes and they think, you know, it's all like that. You know, you just show up for 2 days and you're done.
Right. Well, you know, and honestly, as far as climbing towers, you know, you can take a 1 or a 2 day basic course and grasp the skills that you need to safely, you know, do a lot of the work that's going on, you know, whether it be 4G or just radio work or wireless internet or whatever have you. But what we see happens is you get into the 1 out of 10 random sites where there's a obscure structure, and then they don't know how to get across it or how to work safely. And we always kind of stress the point of, hey, if you can't do something safely, you can't do it. You know, if you need to ask for help, you need to ask for help. You know, that's what we're here for. Give us a call. We've probably been in that scenario, and we can do our best to help you out with it. But rope access is an approach where obviously it's a higher level of training. I mean, we're asking for a full week, but, you know, take us to just about any site out there and we can safely get around and maintain our attachment. And, you know, we're going to go home at the end of the day and coil up our ropes and there you go.
See, rope access, people need to understand how, it's a science, but it's also an art, because I shouldn't say it like that, but a lot of times when you go to a site, you aren't going to do the exact same scenario. You know, there's always something different. You know, you're always going to do things a little differently. I'm not saying the techniques aren't the same. I'm just saying the plan or how you're going to do it is always a little different. And that's why I try to tell these guys, make a plan. The plan may change, because sometimes you're on the ground, you make a plan, you get up in the air and things are different. But at least you have a general idea of what you want to do.
Yep. And one of the things with Sprat, and some people harp on them, is, you know, they say, oh, well, a lot of the skills that you're teaching me are irrelevant. I'm never going to use that out in the field. Well, I'm going to have to disagree with you, because, for one, if you know the skills, there's probably a way you're doing something right now and you're getting it done and it's okay. But I feel like if I show you this other way, you're going to be more efficient, which your boss likes, because you get the work done quicker. And you're also going to be a lot safer, which everybody likes. But when you get into level 2 and you get into level 3, essentially what it is it's more complicated rescues. Now, I got to say, most of the time on a site, if the level 3 rigs the site correctly, we're never, ever going to get into those rescue scenarios. But what it is, is that if you have the knowledge to do those rescues in front of an evaluator, it's rigging concepts. So if you can pull those off smooth and pass your evaluation, then when you're out in the working world, you know how to solve those difficult issues. You know, it's that rigging knowledge that keeps them safe.
Yeah, I believe that. Did you ever climb towers? Were you a tower climber? Did you? Is that how you got into this, or what led up to this?
So I believe it or not, I actually worked in the oil field, and I was working on rigs first, so I was climbing those. From there, I got and I was doing, and you know, some people are like, whatever, you know, those are only 100 feet or whatever, and it's like, you know, there's an element of danger there that the telecom industry doesn't have, and vice versa. So anyway, that was kind of my original introduction to climbing, and then from there, I got into safety and training, and then I came on with Safety One about 6.5 years ago. Got more and more into the tower side of it and the telecom stuff, and then I got into doing Sprat, and then I got to be honest, that's where it became more of a passion than a job, because I just loved it. I had a lot of fun with it.
Oh, that's cool.
And from there, it's like when you start to really love it, you put in way more than the Call of Duty. You know, you're at home reading books at night, you know, sitting around the dinner table with the wife, you're telling her about this crazy knot you just came up with, and she's rolling her eyes at you, but it...
That's funny.
But when you're, as an enthusiast, you know, you kind of push it to that level. And it's the same when you look at guys who do caving, or, you know, any of the tree guys who climb ropes, and not the guys using bucket trucks, but the tree guys who are using ropes. Those guys are hardcore enthusiasts. I mean, they love the stuff, you know, and they can't get enough of it. And that's, you see a lot, it's a labor of love, as a lot of people say.
Yeah. Hey, I believe that, because those tree guys, they do amazing things. And I don't think people appreciate it, but if you ever worked with them or seen them take down a few trees and where they have to go out and they trim it and they, you know, mm-hmm. It's just amazing. And,
they're phenomenal. They're phenomenal.
Oh, I have a friend locally that does it, and it's just, it's amazing for a lot of reasons. You know, growing up, you know, we took down a lot. I grew up on a farm, so we were cutting down trees all the time. But it's amazing because, for one, what they can do with a rope, I can't even imagine, because they're on a tree. They're not on anything really solid, you know what I'm saying? They're up on a tree rig and everything. And then when they take a tree down and they rig it to fall a certain way, if they're good, it always goes that way. I don't know if anyone
absolutely.
Can appreciate it. Yeah, if you don't see it, you don't appreciate it. And I've seen it, and I'm like, oh, my God, how do they do this? You know, it's a sign. I know I always say it's not a science, it's an art, because that's what it looks like. It looks like an art that's so perfect.
Yeah, we were actually doing some rope access training out in a hydro facility in California at a dam. And believe it or not, there was a couple tree guys who were just right in the area, you know, real close to us. And we were kind of shooting the breeze with them, just talking about techniques and things like that. And they had about 110-foot huge tree that they had to take down. And literally on the ground, there was about a 30-foot radius around the tree, and then you had houses all around it. And they took this tree down, and man, he was just phenomenal with his rigging, and he managed to land every single piece of it directly underneath him. He climbed up the whole thing, cut all the branches on his way up, and then he climbed down and cut, you know, 4-foot chunks the whole way down. It was very impressive.
It's amazing. I've seen that too. Well, not probably not quite that tight, but I've seen stuff like that. I when you watch it, you don't really appreciate it till it's all done, and you're like, how did he do that? It was perfect,
right.
The whole thing. So.
Right. You know, and tree guys have a fairly poor safety record. There's a lot of reasons for that. I think a lot of the guys in the industry don't get adequate training, you know, and a lot of trees are around power lines, so you have a lot of issues with guys swinging into live voltage and stuff like that. But there's a percentage of tree guys out there who are true professionals, and they really know what they're doing. And honestly, rope access is kind of the same way. You have guys who, you know, they've been a tower climber for 6 months. They went to REI and bought some rock climbing gear, and they're out there doing rope access, or at least what they would call rope access. You know, to us, when you look for that SPRAT certification, because that's really kind of the barrier to entry to say I'm a qualified technician in our eyes.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you something. Did you get Sprat certified first, or did you start teaching first? Which came first?
I was actually teaching tower climbing prior to getting a Sprat cert. And part of that is because I just didn't know it was out there. I mean, there's a lot of industries, and that's one thing our company does is, you know, our instructors come from just about every at-height background there is. We have a guy who does technical rescue in the fire service. We have a guy who came from a concert rigging background where he used to, you know, build big stages and lift things up in the air over concert stages. We have guys who come from the telecom tower background.
Yep.
We have guys who were linemen climbing electrical structures and everything in between. So what we've done the last few years is actually go out. Our guys take classes all the time. I take classes myself. You know, we've taken all kinds of obscure classes because we're always out there trying to learn, you know, what can we take from, you know, the arborist industry that will help us in our end, you know. What are they doing that would help us? One thing you got to watch is the regulation. You know, we all have different safety regulation that we follow. So with that, changes equipment and techniques quite a bit, too. So,
I was talking to someone the other day about, you know, OSHA. You know, OSHA always, whenever someone gets hurt or there's an injury or a death, OSHA comes in after the fact.
Uh-huh.
And we were talking about falls. You know, falling is the number one killer in the workplace. And when I say falling, I mean off a ladder, down steps.
Yeah, it goes back and forth between that and, what is it, over-the-road driving is a common
yeah.
highway, too.
Yeah, driving's another one. Last year, I think it was falling.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think, is there any way, should OSHA look at falling collectively? When I say falling, let's say off a ladder, off a tower, off a pole, off a tree. Is there a collective way that you think that OSHA could, look at this? Or should they look at each industry individually? They're going to look at each industry individually because there's nuances in each one. You know, obviously tower climbing
yep.
is very different than being in a, you know, a tree service. So, but do you think there's commonalities that they could do, they could look at to prevent as many falls as there are?
Right. So let me think of the best way to answer this.
Not an easy question.
Right. OSHA's, there's basically four parts to OSHA. General industry, construction, agriculture, and maritime. So general industry and construction is the two parts that we work mostly in with what we do. And as a tower climber, really, they're looking at regulations for both. I mean, in all honesty, OSHA does mean very well. You know, a lot of people get this bad taste in their mouth for, oh, man, the OSHA guy's going to come out or whatever. But they're here to protect the employee. So, I mean, in all honesty, the employee should support them like they support the employee. OSHA's done many things over the years to try their hardest to combat that. But I can tell you OSHA's number one priority is what's called imminent danger. So if they recognize that they're in it, and they rank that over death accident investigation. And it makes a lot of sense because if you think about, hey, if we can go out and prevent a death, that's much better than going out to investigate a death today. You know what
yeah.
I mean? So they're going to do that. They have stepped in numerous industries and responded to some of the waves of statistics that we've had. They're doing some things in telecom right now that some people may or may not be aware of, where they're putting some committees together to really study what can be done. In the electrical side, the big thing right now is as of April 2015, all linemen are no longer allowed to free climb transmission towers. And for years and years, that's been allowed, and it's just they've had too many accidents. And, you know, OSHA's kind of come out and said, look, guys, there's too much good equipment and training on the market today. It's just time to get on board with it. You know, it's 2014. Let's get with the times here. And a lot of linemen were fighting it. You know, it's kind of an old school pride thing of you know, I'm a qualified climber. I earned the right to do this. And, you know, we don't want to make our job, you know, so safe that, you know, anybody can do it. You know, we want to keep the club a lead or whatever. So, but in all honesty, people are, you know what, it's like that's the rules, that's the rules, let's go with it, you know. So they're getting on board with it. But I guess to answer your question, you know, it's kind of a classic safety argument of, well, are all accidents preventable? Depends on who you ask. I say no. I'm perfectly likely to trip over my own feet walking through my office today and run into the wall, you know. I'm safer on a tower than I am walking through the office here, I think. But I do think, as far as if you categorize it as what's called falls from elevation, so anytime we're working at height to fall to a lower level, I do think those should be 100% preventable. If we're using good 100% attachment techniques and we're working safely, there should be no reason why anybody should fall to the ground.
Yeah.
Training, obviously, us being a training company, we're going to want to push that, but I do really believe in it. I feel like technique can go a long way. You know, we work with experienced guys all over the place, and, you know, they say, hey, you know, I've been doing it for years, and I was doing it good, but now I can do it even better that you've showed me these techniques, and Spratt has been part of that. So.
Oh, that's good to hear. I always wonder, because sometimes, like you said, are accidents preventable? You'd like to think they are, but you never know. I mean, that's a problem I think OSHA deals with. They're on the site after the fact. You know, they have to figure out what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And people, depending upon what happened, people may or may not be honest. So they really have to not only take in what everybody tells them, but
right.
they also have to look at what's there, you know.
Yep. Well, they're going to come in, and chances are that if you've had a serious accident where you've hospitalized at least 3 people or you've killed at least 1 person, that's a serious accident. They're going to come out, and chances are that if that accident occurred, you should have done something to prevent that accident. You know, there's probably an industry standard which writes a practice that you may or may not been aware of that would have prevented that. And if you've looked at the safety record this year, you know, if you're tracking the number of deaths that we've had in our industry, I got to say the majority of them have not been necessarily just, you know, the classic fall off of a tower. It's been rigging accidents. And a lot of that can be attributed back to improper technique. Overloading equipment, not understanding the forces that are being put on these structures and how we're doing it with these big capstan winches and these drum hoists that we're using. There is better ways to do things than what's out there, but, you know, some of these guys are slamming crews together off the street to try and get sites built, and they're not putting them through the amount of training that they should be.
Well, I agree with that. A lot of it, I think, is education. And some of these accidents, like a block breaks or a rope breaks or snaps or something like that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to wonder, did they not know what the load rating was? I mean, isn't that something you should be thinking about at all times?
Right.
Or, you know, there's things where they just try to haul up too much at one time. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know how much time you're saving by sending up everything in one load when you could send up 2 or 3 loads. I get it.
Yeah.
It's more time and more work. But, you know, I've been there. Sometimes you take everything up in one load. It's a bigger pain because the guy in the towers, you still only have 1 or 2 guys up there that are going to, you know, do whatever with it. And then you got to find a place to put everything. Like if you send up all the bolts, the cable hangers, everything, along with a bracket they have to mount, well, not only do they have to deal with the bracket they have to mount, now they have to find some place to store all these hangers and, you know, all the hardware that they don't need until later.
Yeah, no,
so.
Absolutely. And you know, it's like, where's your documentation for when you last inspected that block?
I mean,
go out to 8 of 10 sites, and I bet you're not going to be able to have anybody show it to you because, you know, they pull it off the truck and it works every day, and they just think it should continue to work every day. And in the grand scheme of things, I mean, why should it, you know, I'm busy, I'm task overload out there. Why should I take an extra hour and inspect all my hardware? You know, I got to get this thing going.
And speaking from experience, that's a mentality. You're out there.
Yep.
Even though you're starting the job, all you want to do is get done.
Yep.
You know, and you're going to get done as fast as you can, just because then you're done. Then you can bill. If you're running the crew, then you can bill. If you're a worker, you get to go home earlier, you know, because chances are you're out of town.
Yep.
So. Yeah.
No, there's still, you know, there's still some flaws in the industry that I see, and I do think we're improving. I think in general people mean well. It's just they're not placing the emphasis that they need to on certain things.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree
and
with that.
Unfortunately, it's kind of a reactive approach where we're responding to accidents, but you know, there's a lot of good information out there right now that will prevent those things, and you know, we just need to take the time to investigate that stuff.
Yeah, we really need to improve.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be done as an industry because you know, I get feedback from a lot of guys. Some guys are like, you're right, we have to be safer, and they take it seriously, but other guys are like, hey, I just got to get done. If I don't get done, I don't get paid, period. And, well, believe me, I understand what you're saying, but the reality is everyone says that until something bad happens. And
oh, sure,
you
absolutely.
Know, yeah, and when there's a serious accident, it's too late. You know, you can look back. That's all you can do. You can't change it. So.
Yep. You know, one thing I see that kind of frustrates me still today is, and you see it with a lot of the real big organizations, and everywhere you look, there's a poster on the wall about safety. Everybody's hard hat has a sticker about safety. You know, they're going to have 8 or 10 safety meetings a day before they do any tasks. They're going to sit around and have a meeting. And, you know, number one, it kind of loses effect when you just hear this safety, 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 safety. That's great. But
yeah.
what does it really mean? And you know, we can sit there and say let's work safely all day long, but you know, hire an outside person to come in and look at what you're doing. You know, have somebody within your organization. A lot of them have very qualified people that they're not utilizing. Have them come out and see if they have any ideas about your site. You know, your rigging techniques, because I got to say again, a lot of the accidents that we read about, it wasn't even that they knew they were doing anything wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
I think one of the problems that a lot of these companies have with the safety guy, I think they approach it, this is going to sound a little silly, but remember, you didn't want to get caught by the teacher because the teacher would discipline you. I think a lot of safety programs are like that. Hey, if you get caught, you're going to get disciplined. And I think your approach, whereas if you have the safety guy that knows, say, more, not more than the climber, but let's say more about climbing or SPRAD certified or more about safety techniques, I think that would be a better approach, because then you would have someone who's teaching out there to teach, not to be a disciplinarian. So,
oh, absolutely.
I think, and I'll tell you what, I've seen it. I've seen companies that take, and this is going to sound bad, but I knew this one person. They made them the safety person, and all that safety person wanted to do was write people up. Didn't know how to do it, didn't understand the job, didn't understand the schedules. All their job was like, oh, they're not following this procedure, they're not following this process. And there's a difference, I think, between the safety person that's out there to help and the safety person that is out there to just prove that they're doing their job, so to speak, you know, prove their
right.
worth by writing people up. And really, if you're good at safety, let's say if that is your job at a company,
mm-hmm.
you're there to teach people how to be safe. You're
yep.
not only going to tell them about the paperwork and the processes, which is what most of them know, and maybe I'm not saying there isn't a place for that. There's people there that's their job. They have to build the processes. They have to create the paperwork, and they have to make sure everything's filed and documented. But there's also, there should be somebody there to teach them, just like you said, the proper
right.
way to do it. And say, hey, if you do this, you'll never get written up. If you pay attention
yeah.
to this, you'll never have a problem. Or, you
right.
know what I mean. I know that's
well,
extreme. But
and, you know, we kind of take that approach, too, because, you know, one word that comes to mind for me is credibility. And if your safety guy is running around with no credibility, you know, he never came from the field. He's not capable of, you know, he's going to go out and do a training class about tower climbing, but
yep.
he can't even fit into a harness because he's 400 pounds and he's never even climbed the tower.
Yeah.
You know, to me, that's not a good way to go, because if the guys in the crew don't know that you can do it yourself or have done it or at least know how to do it, they're never going to give you that respect. And I think if you can come out and earn that respect and get some buy-in from them, that goes a long way. And it's like, hey, guys, well, you know, I'm not here to insult anybody's intelligence. You guys might even have some good techniques that you're using, but let's discuss that. And if it works for you, let's just make sure it's a safe technique, and then you know, let's go with it. And then you kind of give them some buy-in to the whole program because they feel like they have some investment into it, you know?
Yeah, yep. I think that would be a good approach for most safety people. And I think there's going to have to be a change in attitude with the industry, not with the safety industry, but with the climbing industry, and say with a lot of companies where they actually take people that have been in the field. And it's not just climbing, it's any construction job, because I knew construction companies that did the same thing. You know, they would take people that knew nothing about the job. Now, on the other hand, I do know companies that took guys off the field who wanted to get into the safety gig for whatever reason, and they did a great job. It was hard for them because it was a huge learning curve, and all of a sudden, a lot of them had to admit they were doing a lot of things wrong. I knew one guy, I can't remember his name, his first name was John, I can't remember his last name, but he was in construction, and he did a lot. Like, he was an electrician, he did mason, he did a lot of different things. They pulled him into safety, and he said, I never knew how stupid I was till I learned more. You know, he said he just realized how many mistakes he made. Now, the different approach he took is just like we said. He would go up and try to tell people the right way to do things. And he said some guys would listen because he was in the field. And other guys would just say, well, that's because you're in safety now. You want to write people up. But he admitted he didn't want to write people up. That wasn't his job. His job was to tell people how to do things right. So.
Yeah, we try and focus hard on telling people the what, but also the why, because, you know, you can sit there all day and say, you know, do this, do this, do this, you know, and they may not respect that or be resentful against it. But I think if you explain to them why you're doing it, it carries a lot of weight, because you can say, you know, yeah, it is important that you connect your fall protection, and you know, if you don't, here's what a fall can entail, and here's all the injuries you can sustain, and that kind of thing. But it certainly, the safety guy has to have that knowledge of why, so that he can relay those techniques, you know, competently to the end user. I mean, if he just goes around and kind of cracks the whip without having any justification for it, they're never going to respect that. One example that comes to mind for me, it's kind of a funny one. You know, you hear the rules in construction and in general industry of, you know, if we're 4 feet off the ground, we got to be attached. If we're 6 feet off the ground, we got to be attached, yada, yada, yada. Well, the safety guy was brand new, and he just heard that rule somewhere. So he's got guys running around the site on a 6-foot portable ladder with their harness on, and they're clipping off their lanyard to the actual portable ladder, being attached to it. And they're going, dude, this isn't going to do anything. And he's like, hey, man, just do it, you know, and he had no justification for it. And so I actually showed him the regulation under portable ladder section where they can go back and tell him that they don't have to be attached to their 6-foot portable ladder. And they said it kind of ruffled his feathers a little bit. But, you know, I was fine with that, because it's like, if you're going to carry that hat, you got a lot of weight on your shoulders to, A, keep people safe, and B, understand what your job entails so that you can relay that to them.
You know what, that's a great point. I'm always surprised how when someone gets in a position like that, how they quit having conversation and they just start saying, do it because I told you so. You know, it becomes a speech and not a conversation. Whereas the person in that position should get the feedback to figure out how to make things better or to learn. You know, it's a learning process.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, if you keep the attitude that there's always a better way out there to do something, it's just up to us to figure it out. I mean, you keep your eyes open to what else exists. And I mean, we've even looked at other countries. You know, hey, what is Germany doing? What is Japan doing? You know, people have good techniques out there. You know, be open to that stuff. Keep in touch with people. Have a contact around the country. Have a couple of contacts around the world that you call once a year and just shoot the breeze with them for 30 minutes. You know.
Yeah,
hey, what's new over there, you know?
I'll tell you what, if you look at deaths here in the U.S., it just seems like we're getting worse every year. Whereas if you look at Australia, Canada, Germany, you know, the U.K., it just seems like they have such a better record than us. And I know everyone's going to say, well, there's more climbers here. Really, there aren't. You know, I mean, if you look at statistically, you know, the percentage of how many people get hurt here, it's still higher. you know, it's... We have no defense, and we just have to make it better.
Absolutely.
I think the Department of Labor is working towards that. The FCC is stepping in. I'm really happy to see them, you know, trying to help out. You know, they really want to make it a safer industry because it serves everybody if it's a safer industry. So.
You know, just 2 or 3 years ago, and I'm sure this still exists, but, you know, on a Monday, you could have a guy who was a construction worker, you know, working on 6-foot scaffoldings, painting the side of a building.
Yeah.
Gets laid off, and then on Tuesday he gets hired onto a tower crew, and on Wednesday he's out climbing to 100 feet. And if he makes it, you know, a few months and he shows himself, then they'll train him. Well, it seems a little ridiculous that you don't train them before they go out and face the hazards. But, you know, I think what I would like to see, and the industry is sort of going this way, but if you look at linemen, if you look at rope access technicians, what you end up with is a much more qualified technician. You have a guy who he goes and takes a lot of training, and really a week to me is not a lot, but he goes and takes a fair amount of training. From there, he comes out as an apprentice. He does a 6-month or a 1-year, a 2-year apprenticeship. He works underneath qualified people. You know, after then, he goes out to a journeyman level, and then eventually he can run a crew. I know with the demands and workforce surging so often, it's kind of impossible to do that, but I really think that eventually that's the point we should try and get to, where we have people who are true technicians, and they have the training, the equipment, and the skill sets to do all this stuff safely.
Yeah, we have an apprenticeship program, more or less.
Yep. Yeah, there's some of that in the works now, but it's definitely not to the point where it's mainstream.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think, like I said at the beginning of the call, I think in the old days before climbing boomed, I think you had experienced crews out there that would bring on a guy or two at a time, and then you would have that balance of your very experienced guys and just a few new guys that were learning. And
yep.
I think without being told to do so, I think they had their apprenticeship program. I just think it was structured differently than now, you know, now, unfortunately, it just seems like the government has to step in and say, this is how you do it. But I think back then, that's just how they did it. You know, you're the new guy, and you're stuck doing the grunt work for, you know, a couple months, but you'll learn. You know, you'll get out there, you'll get to see what's going on, and the experienced guys would take the time to train everybody. But
yeah.
I think it's like you said, the industry boomed, and they just hired anyone they could to do anything they could for a short period of time.
Well, and on-the-job training is certainly good, but, I mean, OSHA, they're pretty specific. They want to see formalized training with certification.
Yeah.
They want to see everything documented. You know, they like a classroom and a field setting combined. And some way to test somebody, you know, written and hands-on to verify that they've retained the information. And, you know, even that's not a guarantee that they're going to work safely in the field, but it's a very strong start, and it's a good, you know, barrier to entry to say, yes, this individual has been put through all these things and they successfully completed it, and we feel that they're ready to go out to the field under supervision of another qualified person.
Yeah, I agree with that. So moving on, hey, what made you want to teach?
You know, I just kind of got into it at an early age. I actually grew up racing motorcycles, and I was an instructor doing that, and I just really enjoyed it. And then from there, doing the safety thing, it's, you know, I've had jobs in my life that weren't very rewarding, and working at a desk or doing some other things, you know, digging trenches in construction or whatever it may have been, but training safety is very rewarding, especially with this, to know that you can help people to be safer in their daily jobs and go home to their families. It's a cool thing to experience.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I think some people just are natural teachers. So you're probably one of them.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's natural or whatever. I mean, I always tell the instructors when they start here, I'm like, you just kind of suck for the first couple of years you do this, and then eventually, it's not that they can't deliver the information, but it's, you know, our guys spend about 100 days a year in the field training, and it takes about 200 speeches of all different styles to be able to get up and speak very well and, you know, that kind of thing, and it's not for everybody, you know?
Yeah, I believe that. Well, so you have a lot of different students that come through.
Yeah.
Or most of them, yeah, how's that? I mean, I'm sure you have the smart guys. I'm sure you have some guys you just can't figure out, you know, how to teach. You know, you don't want to call them stupid, but you're like, oh, my God, don't you get it?
You know, it's our job as an instructor to be able to figure out everybody's language. And, you know, you may have to explain something 14 different ways before the 14th is what clicks with this individual.
Yeah.
Because it can be frustrating, but that's part of the job, and it's almost why I like it, because it's challenging, you know. And I've had some instructors in my life that I learned things from, you know. I picked up and I'm like, wow, that worked really well, or you know, I definitely don't want to do that kind of thing. But as far as the students here, we absolutely have a variety. We get everything from, you know, the 20-year-old kid who just got out of high school not too long ago and he's figuring out what he wants to do with his life, to the oldest candidate we ever had in Spratt, who actually did successfully achieve level 1, was 69 years old.
Whoa, that's impressive.
Yeah, and he's an animal. He's an animal for his age. But yeah, he achieved Spratt level 1 certification. It was the oldest candidate that our evaluator had ever tested. And you get guys who, I'll tell you the toughest one, and not that I want to pick on them, but it's the engineers. They're completely brilliant when they explain something to you, but when they get on the rope, they just have a hard time. And it's not all of them, but some of them, you know. And the hardest part is, like, you know, for example, like bridge inspections. Well, the engineer is the one that needs to be up there and look at the welds. Well,
yeah.
the rock climbing kid who's 25, who just killed it in the course, is the one who can actually get up there and do it safely. Well, let's hand the 25-year-old a video camera, and then the engineer can watch the video on the ground. There you go. There's your compromise.
Yeah.
So,
why is that? You think the engineers overthink everything? You think they just can't do it? They can't?
That's a lot of it. Is they tend to overthink it. And honestly, it's just, if you haven't, you know, they're kinesthetic learners. These tower guys, and the engineers are more intellectual guys, and it's just one of those things where if you just haven't worked with your hands your whole life, you're going to struggle with some of this stuff. There's a level of coordination and, you know, things that are required to be decent at it.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the heights. If you just cannot get over being deathly afraid of heights, you're not going to be able to focus on what you're doing.
Well, that was I wanted to ask you about that. How many guys, you teach them, you're in the classroom, because you guys do the classroom first. They do great. They seem to know what they're doing, you know, and then they get up at the height, whatever height you go to in class, and they just start to panic, or they're nervous, or they just can't do it. How many people do you have like that? I mean,
So one of the things that we require is that all of our instructors are Spratt certified, and they're very proficient on rope. And the reason for that is because we get about 6 or 7 genuine freakouts a year in training.
Oh, geez.
And so one of the things that our guys do is before they even put anybody on the structure, they've already got a rescue plan rigged up that they can literally have somebody down in 3 or 4 minutes. But I got actually a funny one for you on that. We're an international company, so we travel outside the country, you know, I'd say 8 or 10 times a year doing training in other countries. And myself and another instructor 3 years ago were over in Beirut, Lebanon. We were doing a training, and half the class spoke English and half the class spoke Arabic. And some of them spoke both, and they kind of helped translate things and get the messages across. Well, there was one guy in the class who seemed a little strange, but I couldn't really tell what he was thinking because he didn't speak my language. Well, he gets up about 70, 80 feet in the tower and just has a legitimate freak out, starts screaming obscenities in Arabic, and he wants to, like, I don't know if he's like wants to hug me or fight me or what's going on. And I had to actually tie him up and take him down the tower, and he kind of came in and out of consciousness, and then we had a legitimate rescue on our hands. And
oh my God.
Yeah, he no big deal. We had him down in about 6 or 7 minutes, and we packaged him up. He came to, and he was fine. And then it ended up, what happened was he had never climbed in his life. He was one of the IT guys from engineering. And he just wanted to take the class because he thought it looked fun. And nobody managed to tell us that.
That's so funny. I can't imagine that. I mean, he just took the class, it looked fun, and then he completely panicked.
Hey, oh, man, you... it was, you know, I'll tell you, I was a volunteer firefighter and EMT, so I have a little experience with the emergency services kind of thing, but that one threw me for a curve.
That's bad, man. So, let me ask, like, with these wireless ISPs, you know, they're hiring climbers all the time, and in fact, I think one of them just got cited for, this was a couple of months ago, for not giving their guys the proper safety gear.
Mm-hmm.
Like, these IT guys, you have a lot of IT guys that come through, because most IT guys hardly ever, and I'm not busting on IT guys here, they're really
sure.
smart guys, but most of them hardly ever get up from the chair and away from the laptop unless it's on the way to the snack machine. And I'm not busting on them, but I work with a lot of them.
No, I get it. I see that too. Where we usually see that, to be honest with you, is in the government facilities, military installations, county radio departments, things like that, where as a job description, they're required to have the cert, but in all actuality, they're never going to climb because they're always going to call in sick if they know that there's an antenna that needs to be mounted or, you know, whatever it is. There's usually one or two guys out of eight who really like it, and then they do all the work, and no one else does any of the work. And although they own a harness, they've never actually put it on. But as part of their job, they're required to maintain the cert. So you can usually spot those guys because at the very thing, first thing in the morning when we get there, they actually have to fill out their documentation, and one of them is to sign a liability release, which all of the companies have. And they'll find something in there that they don't like and say, well, I can't sign this till I speak with my lawyer. And by the time they talk to their lawyer and get back, the training's over and they can't participate. And yeah, so anyway, it's...
That's funny, they find a loophole to get out of it.
they'll look for something, or they'll say, I'm having chest pain or shortness of breath, because those are the two things that you just can't ignore. And they know the game pretty well, and some of them will get up there and just go through it because they have to, and they'll do okay, and, you know, it is what it is, so.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny. I know a ton of IT guys, probably like everyone does. Anywhere you work now, you have a couple IT guys. And
mm-hmm.
Not many of them like to do the physical labor. I mean,
I'll tell you what the bigger company, like what we see with Verizon and some of the bigger companies, is they've got some very, very qualified IT guys who will show up. You know, they drive their snowcat up and they take their computer and they plug in at the base and at the site, do all the programming, and then they'll bring other guys to actually do the climbing. And most of them are actually contracting that stuff out, but they don't want to do it anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And that's fine.
It.
If they don't want to do it, they shouldn't do it, you know?
No, that I agree with. I don't think you should. Some of these guys do it because they feel they have to do it, even though they don't like to do it. It just makes it bad for everybody.
Absolutely.
So, wow. So you've had to rescue people. I mean, do you normally... For you personally, like, how many people a year do you rescue, like, through training?
Me personally, I get two or three legitimate ones a year. And that's probably about the same for the other instructors here, too. So we've got probably about five of our tower guys do the majority of the at-height training. So I'd say, you know, maybe 15 a year or so that we get.
Wow.
And That's a big number, but on the other hand, it's better to figure that out when we're there than when we're not there.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, totally agree with you. Yeah, because you're there, you're qualified, you're prepared. It's a staged environment.
Exactly.
So I got another question I got to ask you. So when I went to training, I took it pretty seriously, right? But there's always those guys that they're out of town, they're there, they want to party the night before, and they come in hungover. How many guys do you deal with like that? I mean, what average, you know? Are there a lot? Is it a few? Or aren't there any? Do most guys take it pretty seriously?
Well, I got to say, it's kind of tough because you're training people that a lot of times you don't know.
Yeah.
So you don't really know if someone's hungover and grouchy, that may actually be their happy face. You just don't know them, you know.
Good point.
I will say that if we smell booze or something like that on them, we call it out and we don't let them climb. It's just unacceptable. Can't have that. But we always say that there's three types of students. There's participants, there's vacationers, and then there's prisoners. And it's our job to try and get everybody to be a participant as soon as possible and get engaged with what they're doing. And I'll tell you, we try very hard to put on a great class. And a lot of the guys come in as prisoners because they're thinking, man, I've been climbing 10 years. This is stupid. What the heck am I going to learn? And, you know, we get a real strong introduction. We try and connect with them on their level and let them know that we are climbers just like they are. And we're here to help them do their job, not tell them what to do. And I think we're pretty good at turning that around real soon in the day.
Yeah, I think the way you relate to people and probably just showing them that there have been changes, you know, there are things they can do better. I think most climbers who do it for a living, you know, it's their job, would take that seriously. But I agree with you. They probably come in with, like, what are you going to teach me? I do this every day. And they probably leave saying, wow, it was actually pretty good.
Yeah. No, I can look back. There's actually a couple days that have stuck in my mind that I will never forget, you know, and it's typically the guy who's, you know, twice my age and he's ready to retire this year and he's just going to have some fun with me, you know, that kind of stuff. But I don't mind it. You know, I take a lot of pride in what I do, and in all honesty, you know, climbing is, you know, maybe 20 to 40% of their job. It's 100% of mine.
Yeah.
So if I'm not two or three levels above my audience, you know, then there's a problem anyway.
That, you know, you brought up a good point. That's a good thing to look at because, back when I climbed, when you first start out, you're climbing all the time. But then as the years go on, you're climbing, you know, I was doing more computer work, managing crews, and, you know, the climbing goes down and down for some people, not for all, but for me it did. So I might have been climbing 50% of the time, and then, you know, maybe 25% of the time, just because that's the way the job started to balance out. You know,
uh-huh.
You start doing more and more of the planning, the managing, and then I did a lot of engineering work as well. So I think you're right. I think a lot of guys come in there and think they know it all.
Mm-hmm.
And I know from experience, I would go back to the instructor's class and the training class every year. I do it every year. But I would go back every year, and I would think, well, you know, what's new? And there was always something new. And I think you got to be open-minded, which I feel I am. Not always,
yeah.
I admit it. But you got to be open-minded when you go into class because, yo, that's changed. And sometimes you do get the attitude that, oh, well, the way I do it is better. And I think I think most people think that. It's not that it's better. It's just it's what they're used to. You know, it's hard to change. And I think that's something you probably run into a lot. A lot of guys just don't want to change.
Oh, yeah. And honestly, I mean, that's where, you know, we were talking earlier about the safety guy who just says, wear your hard hat because I told you so, but he can't actually tell you why to wear your hard hat. You know, it's the same thing. If I go out, you know, I'll give you an example. I just got in yesterday. I was in New York for 3 days this week doing training with some guys, and these were 15-year guys, very experienced. They've been through 6 or 7 other courses, you know, so I'm pulling out all my rabbits out of hats to try and give them something new and exciting. And, you know, probably half the stuff that they had, I'm like, I'll be honest, guys, the way you're doing it is fine. You know, my way is a little different. Here's why I do it my way, but your way is actually fine. Go ahead. If you want to do it that way, there's nothing wrong with that. And that, I think that gains you a lot of respect with them because, you know, you kind of give them some credibility for what they do and their background. You know, as an instructor, I'm never going to want to go in and say, oh, your way sucks, do it my way. You know, they're going to throw me out in about 5 minutes, you know. So if they've got some good techniques, let's start there, and then maybe I can expand on it.
Oh, yeah. That's a good plan.
You know? But, you know, you deal with enough guys, and you just kind of learn to work with them better and better all the time.
Oh, well, I appreciate you taking the time, Todd. I really do. I just can only imagine, like, you probably have good weeks and bad weeks when you're training people, but you seem to enjoy it.
Oh, it's, it's all over the board. There's one thing about this job, as crazy and stressful as it may be at times, it's never boring. There's some groups we do, and we do repeatedly, and I almost... I kind of like, man, I got to get excited to go back to that group again, because some of these groups are, we work with big groups who paint towers and stuff like that. And some of these guys are just, they're just animals. I mean, they're built to be a tower painter. Let's just say that. And, it's fun if you can have fun with them and show, if you're passionate about it, they will be too.
Yeah.
But anyway, I appreciate the opportunity, and we're happy to talk to you anytime. And if we can help people work safer, we're going to do that.
No, I appreciate it. All right, well, I'll let you go, Todd. Again, thanks for your time, and I'll get in touch with you. I'll send you a couple emails. Maybe I'll call you, let you know what's going on. I'll probably have this out in a week or so, just so you know.
Sounds great. Yeah, just email's the best way because I'm always out traveling, working with guys. But send me an email, and... we'll do what we can to get it put together for you.
All right. You got it. Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hey, you're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
See ya.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. You still there? I hope you enjoyed that. That was Todd with Safety One. He took the time out just so we could have that little chat. And it was just something that I think that we overlook what the trainer does. So I hope you appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed it. And again, for all you people out there interested in more information on training, there's a lot of companies out there that train. Safety One's a good company, and I just happen to know some of the guys over there. So, and there's always more schools and so on popping up every day because these guys are busy. They also train on site, so they'll come to you. Because you heard Todd talk in there about going to different countries to train people in different regions. So it's one of those things where it's not just a classroom. You have to actually go out in the field. And for all you guys that work in the field, now you know you're not alone. These guys have to do it too. And they have to be well prepared to rescue someone on the spot because people do freeze up in the tower. Also, like I said, I should have my new book out soon. I'm going to put together a bunch of small books this time, a bunch of PDFs on how to do the paperwork. And I want to make sure you guys knew that. So if you're still listening, I just want you to know it's coming out soon. And I thought I'd put a twist on it by not only having the books, but putting out the audio portion as well. And I thought maybe you guys could actually use this for training. So the whole idea is to train people on how to read the paperwork, how to understand the paperwork, and how to do the paperwork. So I think one of the things when I was out in the field, and as you want to get better and progress, you overlook the paperwork a lot of times. So that's why I thought I'd put this out there to answer your questions, because I know it's frustrating because a lot of guys just feel like they can't do the paperwork or they don't understand it. It's relatively easy once you understand it, but other than that, it's a little confusing at first. So that was my goal here, to help you guys understand not only what you're doing, but where the directive comes from, how to work with the customer, and also how to translate that work to the job. And for you guys that are estimators or out there doing the bidding, you guys need to not only understand the scope, but sometimes you may need to rewrite the scope or write a scope for the customer. So I started with a scope of work. I'm going to do the bill of materials and so on. Everything's pretty straightforward, but hoping it helps, guys. I'm here to help. And remember, guys, be smart, be safe, pay attention to what you're doing. There's going to be a plan. Follow the plan, and you're going to have to deviate from the plan to make things right. But just be smart, be safe, pay attention. And when you get home at night, arrive alive. You're only going to do that by following the plan, paying attention to what you're doing. Take care.